The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Dr. Jean Rhys Bajalan is a historian of the Middle East, specializing in the rise of nationalism and the evolution of the Kurdish question. And in this episode of Zero Squared, we discuss the Kurdish question and the right to national self-determination. It's Thursday, August 20th, 2020, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publishing manager of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. If you enjoy the Zero Books podcasts, including Zero Squared and Pop the Left, support us on Patreon. Patreon supporters get access to all of our podcasts and live streams, and this week our patrons will get access to a video version of this podcast. It is our Patreon support that funds our digital content. The music you're listening to right now is an instrumental version of the Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy of Company B from the Hit Crew. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Jean Bajalan and I discuss the national question and the Kurds. Dr. Jean Rhys Bajalan is an historian of the Middle East, specializing in the rise of nationalism and the evolution of the Kurdish question, or the struggle for Kurdish independence, maybe. He is a professor of history at Missouri State University, and this is, I think, your second time on the podcast.
Yes, second time on the podcast, I think. Second.
And you are also were a frequent guest on the Michael Brooks Show. So I'm really glad to get you on. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Douglas.
Yeah. Since we've lost Michael Brooks, I mean, it's been a real blow to the left, and it's been difficult for me to process. But one of the things that I have decided that I'm going to try to do to not just honor his memory, but also to keep his project and his contribution to the left as alive as I can, is to try to expand my range a little bit, get outside of my comfort zone, and have something more of an internationalist outlook. I'm glad that you're on, and you said you're going to help me with that as we go forward from here. And I'm not going to be anywhere near as good as Michael was, but I'm going to try to learn as we go.
Yeah, I definitely think Michael's going to be missed because, you know, he filled a void, especially in the left media space, talking about leftist politics from an internationalist perspective. And he just had such a range, you know, that I don't think there's anyone else in left media who was doing what he was doing. And, you know, he was just getting really started on his career. So it's such a tragedy that he passed. And I know we'll miss him.
Yeah. I mean, I really mostly felt badly for him. I just felt like he was robbed of a life that I know he was really enjoying, and that he had a lot of ambition to do many things. And I just felt it was, you know, I wanted to shake my fist at God for him dying so young. But I'm beginning to feel the loss for everybody else too. Now it's
it's a difficult time.
Yeah. But let's start talking about another difficult subject. And you recently wrote an essay called The Elusive Quest for a Kurdish State. And you wrote that the most recent struggle for national self-determination started in 2014 when Masoud Barzani, the leader of the Kurdistan Democratic Party, and the president of the autonomous Kurdistan region in Iraq, called for a referendum on independence. Can you give us that recent history, kind of outline what happened with the referendum and what the U.S. role
was in the suppression of that movement?
Sure. So, you know, when we're looking at the evolution of Kurdish nationalism in Iraq and the context for the referendum, we can go, you know, right back to the foundation of the Kingdom of Iraq. We can go to the 1958 revolution. We can go to the 1991 uprising, which led to the creation of the autonomous region. But, you know, obviously you can always push the historical context back. But, you know, I think the most relevant thing, at least to understand the sort of near-term factors that explain the emergence of this sort of push for a referendum in 2014, which ultimately proved unsuccessful in 2017, was the aftermath of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. You know, there was an autonomous region created after the first Gulf War with American support for various reasons. And during the Iraqi invasion, the Iraqi Kurds, who controlled basically three provinces in the north of the country, joined the American offensive and played a critical, well, a quite important military role in the northern front of the war. And sort of this secured their autonomy, which had been up till then kind of a little bit in limbo. You know, Iraq was under sanctions. The KRG was an autonomous region supported by the United States, but it was still technically part of Iraq, so it was under sanctions. Its status was dubious because the Iraqi central government had pulled out. But after playing an important role in aiding the Americans, the Iraqi Kurds sort of managed to have their autonomy enshrined in the new Iraqi constitution. And Iraqi Kurdistan underwent somewhat of a boom. In economic terms, there was a high oil price. The region was relatively stable compared to the rest of Iraq. So there was a significant degree of, you know, development in terms of, you know, a lot of construction, a lot of companies moving into the region. When I first went to Iraqi Kurdistan in 2004, you know, it was sort of a desolate place without, you know, any major construction for, you know, decades. But, you know, when I moved there in 2014, you know, I could barely recognize the place. You had chain restaurants, you had high-rise apartment buildings and numerous construction projects underway, malls, all these kind of things. You know, very superficial kind of development in certain ways based on an oil boom, but significant for the people who lived there. Now, the problem was, though, that the geographical limits of the KRG were never really defined. There were certain regions, including an oil-rich region around Kirkuk, as well as other sort of regions on the border of the KRG and the Iraqi government, such as the town of Khan Yunis, where my family is from. These regions were a bone of contention between whether they should be part of the KRG or should be under Iraqi central government control. And these issues were supposed to be dealt with in a referendum. They were supposed to be dealt with, you know, through constitutional means. But because of the sort of the highly controversial nature of this, the Iraqi central government and the KRG never came to kind of a conclusion on this. And this sort of served to undermine relations between Baghdad and Erbil, the capital of the autonomous region, especially during the administration of Nouri al-Maliki, who increasingly began to take a more hostile and hardline approach towards the KRG. There were numerous disputes, not only the territorial disputes, but disputes over oil exploration, over oil exporting rights, over budgets, you know, like where the Iraqi government was obliged to give a certain percentage of the oil revenues to the KRG. There was disputes over whether they were receiving them and so on and so forth. So you had these numerous niggling issues between the two sides, which basically ISIS came in and kicked over the cart and led to the complete collapse of the Iraqi state in the north of the country, which basically gave the Iraqi Kurds the opportunity to move in to the territories, the disputed territories, and occupy them and sort of satisfy their territorial demands in Iraq, which then Masoud Barzani and the Kurdish Democratic Party in particular, the dominant political party in Iraq, Kurdistan, saw this as an opportunity to push for full independence, as that, you know, they had created facts on the ground. They controlled Kirkuk's oil. They had their troops stationed in the disputed territory. Now, this plan was, initially floated in 2014, but in the late summer of 2014, ISIS turned from attacking Iraqi central government forces and moved to attacking the KRG and basically humiliated the KRG forces, forcing them back. The U.S. moved in to protect Erbil, the capital, from ISIS's advance. And the whole issue of the referendum was basically put off until the threat of ISIS was, dealt with. Nuri al-Maliki fell. There was a new fell in Baghdad. There was a new administration. The United States and Iran cooperated to deal with Iraq. Then, by 2017, most of ISIS had basically been pushed out of the regions that it had seized control of. And so the KRG, which still controlled Kirkuk and this oil-rich region, moved forward with the referendum. There was great hostility, not only from Baghdad, but also from Turkey, from Iran, both of which have, complicated relations with the Kurdish autonomous region in Iraq. So you had that dynamic playing in. But the Kurds looked to the United States to act as some kind of guarantor for their referendum. The referendum was always pitched as significantly. It was always pitched as being a bargaining tool. So they wanted to get sort of a legitimacy for independence. They wanted to get a popular mandate for independence and then perhaps use that to negotiate a more favorable deal with Baghdad. But ultimately, the United States did not step in to protect the Iraqi Kurds. The Iraqi Kurds had put a lot of faith in the United States. They had people in the administration, or at least close to administration, who had, been relatively pro-Kurdish, at least in their rhetoric, obviously not in practice. And basically, following the referendum, after a couple of weeks of tensions, Iraqi army and the Iraqi militias, in particular popular mobilization forces, attacked Iraqi Kurdish positions in Kirkuk. And following the retreat of one of the main Kurdish political parties, the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, which had made a deal with the Iraqi government, the Kurdistan Democratic Party forces loyal to that particular party, were sort of left out in the open, and they were forced to retreat back. The Iraqi army did not push on, there was a few further offensives and some fighting, but they didn't move to overturn the autonomous region in its entirety, but they basically asserted central government control over those disputed territories and forced the KRG to the Kurdish regional government, the autonomous region, to renounce the referendum, to declare it illegitimate. And basically, we've kind of gone back to a pre 2014 situation. Masoud Barzani was forced from office, but power fell to his relatives, his son and his nephew, mm-hmm. Who occupy the presidency and the premiership of the KRG. The Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, which is the kind of second party in Iraqi Kurdistan, maintains effective control over their stronghold, which is this province of Sulaymaniyah, one of the three autonomous provinces that make up the autonomous region of Kurdistan. They remained in place. So we've kind of sort of gone back to a kind of pre-2014 situation where nothing's really resolved, but the Kurds have basically been forced to give up any hope of independence in Iraq, at least for Iraqi Kurdistan, in the near future. And it's important to emphasize this. The Iraqi Kurds were fastidious in emphasizing that they only pursued independence for Iraqi Kurdistan. They did not want to change existing international frontiers. They just wanted a new international frontier between Baghdad and a new state of Kurdistan. So, there's a couple of... So basically, we have this kind of situation which has put Kurdish hopes of independence on the back burner in Iraqi Kurdistan, at least for the foreseeable future. I don't see them becoming, unless there's some radical transformation in Baghdad, I don't see independence returning to the political agenda in Iraqi Kurdistan, especially because now there are further economic problems. You've got COVID, the oil price is so low, the region is bankrupt. So it's a little bit of a mess.
Well, I have a couple questions of kind of follow up on all that. One is when you're talking about areas that are rich in oil and a dispute and basically competition for control of those resources between the Iraqi state and a newly forming Kurdish state, are you talking about a situation where the oil is already nationalized and it would be a matter of sharing between political states, or are you talking about competition between private owners, bourgeois people of different ethnicities, or which one?
Yeah, so I'm not a super expert on the ins and outs of the oil industry, but mm-hmm. You do have a state oil company in Iraq. You also mm-hmm. have private oil companies involved. So you basically have oil that was already in production. Mm-hmm. And then you have the question of new oil fields opening up and private companies coming involved in those oil fields. Iraqi Kurdistan wanted to control the pre-existing Kirkuk oil field, which has been part of the Iraqi sort of oil sector for a long time. So that's one question. But then there's an additional question of within the KRG, there are several natural gas and oil sites, and the KRG wants to be able to basically farm out the contracts to different companies to exploit that oil, right? And there's also a dispute. The Iraqi central government wants a lot more state oversight over oil production, whereas the concessions that the Iraqi Kurdish government is granting are a lot sort of less, a lot more generous to international oil companies. But of course, there's always a high risk. Iraq still has a huge oil sector, so oil companies are very reticent about sort of getting involved in Iraqi Kurdistan, lest it jeopardize their opportunities in the rest of Iraq. So there's a complicated system of state oversight and involvement. Iraq's oil was nationalized, obviously, under the previous regime. So we basically have these two questions of what's the future for oil exploration and who has the right to grant those contracts. Mm-hmm. And it's ultimately actually comes down to a conflict between state prerogatives, whether the regional government controls its national resources. And you hear different things from different sides, so often it's difficult to get to the truth of the matter. But, whether the Iraqi Kurdish government can sign the oil contracts with the companies it wants to, but then has to deliver the oil revenues to a central pot, or whether they can take that money directly from their oil contract. So there's a lot of details that sometimes, unless you're really into the nuts and bolts of this, can be a little bit unclear. But ultimately, the fight is over, who physically exercises state power over oil fields, and mm-hmm. B, who has the fundamental right to sign oil contracts for new exploration.
Right. And so these oil companies will come in and they'll get contracts from the state to drill for oil or to pump out the oil mm-hmm. and make a profit that way. And they're paid, but they're paid by the state. The state maintains control over the oil.
Yeah, Iraq is very wary of the kind of, given the history of foreign exploitation of Iraqi oil, there is a lot of reticence amongst Iraqis about handing over too much to foreign companies. Now, of course, they need the foreign companies because Iraq's oil industry, nationalized oil industry, needs investment. At the time of the Iraq War, it's antiquated. The sanctions had sort of devastated the infrastructure of the country. So they do need the expertise, but they are careful in granting too generous agreements with foreign oil companies. And that's one of the differences between the KRG and the Iraqi central government, is that the KRG is, partly for political reasons, they want to have oil companies deeply invested in their region, so their contracts or what they're offering is often more generous than what the Iraqi central government is.
They could use these foreign allies to protect them. And
exactly. The Iraqi Kurds are not ignorant of the influence of the oil companies in directing policy. They're naive in believing that, you know, a big oil company would sacrifice its position in Iraq and perhaps other countries that maintain good relations with Iraq for the KRG. The payoff for them might not be good. But you do get companies, you know, all kinds of companies sniffing around Iraqi Kurdistan, Turkish oil companies. Mm-hmm. One of the things that the Iraqi Kurds have tried to do to avoid conflict with Turkey is to get Turkey to invest money in the KRG region. So basically, economically speaking, Iraqi Kurdistan is basically a Turkish colony in the sense that, you know, Turkey exports, it builds infrastructure there. Turkish chains set up services. So, you know, there's basically you have capital invested there, and then you have Iraqi Kurds buying mainly Turkish manufactured goods. If you go to Iraqi Kurdistan, most of the products, whether that's clothing, whether that's white goods, you know, fridges and things like that, construction, these are all Turkish companies doing that. So a lot of the capital in Iraqi Kurdistan flows into Turkey. So this is one of the other insurance policies to try and avoid, too aggressive a Turkish policy, which to some extent worked because, mm-hmm. you know, even when Turkey was vigorously opposing the Iraqi Kurdish referendum and speaking very strongly, shutting down the airline flights, they never fully closed the border because there's billions of dollars of trade between the two sides. So mm-hmm. they don't want to shoot themselves in the foot either.
When ISIS took over, did ISIS take over the regions that were oil rich?
They did take over some oil producing regions, but like place like Kirkuk, basically because of American air power, remained in the hands of the Kurds right down until the referendum and the central government's seizure of that region. So ISIS took some fields. They took fields in Syria as well. Mm. And you know, they were illegally export. You know, they were smuggling oil out. They were smuggling all kinds of things out. They smuggled oil out. They smuggled artifacts out. So, you know, people might know Hobby Lobby. Hobby Lobby was actually indirectly purchasing artifacts from ISIS to fill their biblical museum up. So, you know, you have all these bizarre things taking place.
I would think that the ISIS would be severely constrained as opposed to, the Iraq, for instance, in terms of its ability to do much with the oil, that the black market wouldn't be as profitable and that you wouldn't be able to sustain as much.
They had to sell that cheaply to smugglers to get across the border. ISIS was, you know, obviously ISIS were a horrific terrorist organization, extremely brutal, they were involved in the genocide of the Yazidi people. They were butchering Shias, you know, massacring people. But, you know, as a long-term threat to the security of the region, their success was more the aberration than being overthrown. Once the KRG, the United States, and the Iraqi central government, mobilized, they were gradually pushed back. You know, they did not have, you know, they were temporarily boosted when they seized Mosul because they seized the weaponry from a lot of the Iraqi military. So they had a lot of American equipment to start off with. But obviously that needs maintaining. You need ammunition and so on and so forth. So, you know, they were very successful initially. You know, they had this blitzkrieg strategy of basically outflanking units of the Iraqi army or the Peshmerga, the Iraqi Kurdish security forces, causing them to panic, and then people would flee, right? Because they were so terrifying. But, you know, once air power came in, they were pretty much stopped dead. And then it became a sort of a war of attrition where they were driven back. So they had highly motivated soldiers. But the resources of the United States, of the Iraqi central government, of the KRG, of Iran, all these forces mobilized against ISIS, and you know they were, their destruction was inevitable. So it was that, you know, there was a lot of panicking, you know, in, you know, the summer of 2014 that ISIS were going to take over Baghdad, but that was never really a realistic prospect. You know, ISIS invading a city of what, 5-6 million armed Shias is not a taking over a demoralized Iraqi military bases in a predominantly Sunni region in the north of the country is a very different thing from sort of launching an offensive on a city of 5-6 million with armed militias organized and things like that. So it was a big humiliation and everything, but they were never really the existential threat to the neighboring powers. They were obviously an existential threat to anyone in Iraq because of their sheer level of brutality.
Yeah, this brings to mind some questions I think might come up a little bit in a few minutes around the progressive nature of capital and the limits it might put on authoritarianism, which are not obviously anywhere near severe enough limits, but nonetheless that there might be some limits that capital puts on those authoritarian institutions. And we'll bring that up in the context of Lenin's support for national determination or and self-determination, maybe. But I have another question I had written down, and that has to do with the Kurdish politics. And when you're trying to make sense from the outside of Kurdish politics, one of the things that I ran up against is the fact that there are so many different political factions or parties within what we might think of as a Kurdish nation, which for instance, you know, it's spread across four different authoritarian nations, the Kurds territory, and then in each section, like, you have 19 parties in Iraq, you have 7 in Iran, 31 in Turkey, including, and this is, I found this interesting, there's the Communist Party of Kurdistan, the Workers' Vanguard Party of Kurdistan, the Marxist-Leninist Communist Party of Kurdistan, the Communist Party of Turkey, Leninist Party, I guess, and the Revolutionary Party of Kurdistan, and on and on and on. Lots of would-be or nominally Marxist organizations, I guess, within Kurdistan or what will be Kurdistan. And then there's 14 in Syria and so on. So I guess my question to you is, am I getting an accurate picture at all of how unified or fractured the Kurdish people are when I look at all these different parties that are spread throughout the region?
Yeah, I mean, it's important to understand that in each different part of Kurdistan, you know, we can talk about Kurdistan as a sort of cultural zone, as an aspirational nation state, as a, you know, a cultural geography. But, you know, in political terms, the region has been, since the end of the First World War, divided between, you know, Iraq, Iran, Syria, Turkey, there's a little bit within the Soviet Union, and so on. And one thing to understand is that the political dynamics of each of the different states within the within which the Kurds reside has fundamentally shaped the evolution of Kurdish politics and Kurdish nationalism in each of those different parts of Kurdistan. Mm-hmm. So the dynamics that, you know, of course, there are shared sort of cultural traditions, there are shared historical narratives between all the different Kurdish movements across what we might call Greater Kurdistan. But within Iraqi Kurdistan, Iranian Kurdistan, Turkish Kurdistan, and Syrian Kurdistan, you know, you have very specific movements that have been shaped by the political dynamics in each of those countries. So, you know, we can talk about a broad Kurdish identity and an aspiration for a unified Kurdish nation, but we can also talk meaningfully about an Iraqi Kurdish nation, a Syrian Kurdish nation, a Turkish Kurdish nation. And, you know, this is even reflected in the language of Kurdish nationalists. Kurds will often refer to the, you know, Northern Kurds, which is sort of a word for Kurds from Turkey, even though some regions of Iranian Kurdistan are more further north than regions of Turkish Kurdistan. So this Northern Kurdistan is usually what Kurdish nationalists will refer to Kurds from Turkey, Southern Kurdistan, Iraqi Kurdistan, Western Kurdistan. The word Rojava, which you probably hear in relation to Syria means west. West, so Western Kurdistan refers to that. So you do have these very distinct political cultures. So there, a good comparison might be with perhaps Arab nationalism or even German nationalism. You know, Austrians and Germans can be thought of as a different nation, as an Austrian nation and a German nation, but they, you know, there are many people, at least, you know, in the 19th century who regarded them as being naturally part of the same nation, but living in two different states has created a distinctly Austrian nation and a distinctly German nation, and a distinctly Swiss German nation as well. Mm-hmm. So Eric Hobsbawm, you know, he put it quite well, and I'm probably going to misquote him, but he basically says that, you know, it is states and nationalisms that make nations and not the other way around. And I always like to add to that, you know, sometimes the state makes the wrong nation because they oppress a group so much that that group comes to see itself as being part of a distinct nation, whereas had other political choices being made, they might have seen themselves as being part of a different kind of national community, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It really complicates things, though, because before I talked to you and in preparation for another podcast that I'm going to be doing and this one, I was reading Lenin and Stalin about the question of self-determination. Stalin's essay from, I think, 1905 or so. Mm-hmm. Before he was the Stalin we know. And I'm not saying he was a good guy then, but I'm just saying, you know, he had a different views. But the development of what gives a group the right of self-determination from, like, Stalin's point of view was the fact that they had a shared language, a shared territory, a shared fate or national outlook, and not so much that they already had a state. That would be, you know, something that they would have the right to form, and that they could be within a state and still have these other characteristics. So on the other hand, if you think about the struggle for nationalism itself, as Hobsbawm put it, creating this shared identity and the shared sense of fate, and then it becomes a very difficult question to determine what is really grants a group the right of self-determination.
Well, I think, you know, there's a couple of issues that come here. Firstly is a linguistic issue. You know, yeah. Like in the English language, we use the term nation to mean multiple different things, right?
Right.
When we talk about someone's nationality, we talk about their, you know, we're usually talking about their citizenship, not what they innately feel like. It's just, right. Whereas, you know, using a term like nation in Central Europe or in Russia had a different connotation, and they have a more nuanced vocabulary to discuss different types of community. Then we also have the sort of historical evolution of a term like nation, which, you know, originates, you know, things like nation, patriotism. These all come from terms that used to refer to someone's particular locale or home region rather than something like that. So this is a kind of vocabulary issue. Now, with Stalin specifically, and this also was a problem that afflicted Wilsonian notions of national self-determination, was, you know, there was a desire to find an objective list of criteria that allows one to define what a nation is, that you can sort of, you can count these kind of things, and if a community has all these things, then they constitute a nation. If they don't have them, they don't constitute a nation. Now, and this gets to a debate, which, you know, it continues today. People like Hobsbawm and Benedict Anderson, you know, have often emphasized sort of the subjective nature of nationhood vis-a-vis kind of more objectivist understandings of nationhood. And this debate goes back to the 19th century. The philosopher Ernst Renan, you know, sort of in a dialogue with sort of more blood and soil communitarian nationalism in Germany sort of presented a kind of voluntaristic nationalism as the French nation has been this kind of voluntary unit where different communities come together. And this sort of gives us this, you know, dichotomy we have today. It originates from this concept of Eastern and Western nationalism. Eastern nationalism is cultural. It's sort of a little bit reactionary, retrograde, whereas Western nationalism is this kind of voluntary, rational type of nationalism, British nationalism, French nationalism, and American nationalism. And, you know, this continues today with our discourse of civic versus ethnic nationalism. Now, obviously, this dichotomy is kind of is misleading, because within any given national group, you will have sort of more organicist understandings of what the nation is and more civic-minded notions of what the nation is. Mm-hmm. You could be a kind of Republican Frenchman who believes that it's just about language, usually there's a racial element hidden underneath it. Mm-hmm. Or you could be an organic French nationalist who believes that you're the descendants of the Gauls. You know, each national, the theoretician of nationalism, John Hutchinson, you know, he talks about nations as zones of conflict, where you have different narratives and understandings of what the nation is competing with each other. We see this in America, the liberal fantasy of America as this nation of melting pot of immigrants, where, you know, everybody's united around sort of worship of the Constitution, of the founding fathers, and a particular sort of national destiny, versus a racialized notion of American nationalism, where only particular ethnic and religious groups can be part of that. So every nationalism has these different tendencies within them. And secondly, civic nationalism, although often presented as being the more civilized form of nationalism, as it's voluntarist, right, can also be extremely aggressive, because the notion comes, if you refuse to assimilate, then it's not that you're part of a community that can never be assimilated, but that you are refusing to join the nation. So we see this in Algeria with the French. Obviously, there's a racial aspect to it, a religious aspect. But, you know, the official discourse was like, these Muslims refuse to give up their Islamic family law and mm-hmm. come under French civil law. So they're choosing. It's their choice. So civic nationalism can be just as brutal. Turkey, at least historically, has had a strong civic nationalist sort of narrative about it. You know, Atatürk has a saying, the founder of modern Turkey, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, had a saying, is happy is he who calls himself a Turk. And sort of Republican Turkish nationalists will often say, he doesn't say happy is he who is a Turk, happy is he who calls himself a Turk. So those Kurds who don't want to call themselves Turks, they're the ones making their own problems, because the door is open if you only assimilate. So we have these kind of paradigms, different paradigms of nationalism.
I just want to jump in and say one thing here. Well, you know, this is the one thing that reading Lenin helped me understand was that first of all, reading about the debate within Marxism made me understand that there are multiple justifications, just like the ones you mentioned, within the Marxist tradition, right? I mean, there are people who thought it was a matter of national character, the psychological predisposition, that kind of thing that came out of history, or that it was mostly cultural. No one would argue in the Marxist tradition that it was racial, particularly, mm-hmm. right? But and the blood and soil was out the window. But there were still debates about just what constituted a nation. I think from a Marxist perspective, though, it would be about the people in a territory controlling their own resources, and what created the nation as it was known in Europe in the 19th century, as it came up in Europe in the 19th century, was not just the rational, voluntary choices of peoples, but the development of capitalist relations.
Yes.
And the need for a new form of self-organization to match up with the progressive nature of capitalism, as well as the development of a working class, which would even go beyond capitalism. But for Lenin, the idea was, you know, you want to have the most progressive form of government you can to facilitate the development of capital. And that would be a liberal bourgeois state that was representative of the people of that community. And that's what would set up the right to self-determination.
Yeah, I mean, throughout the 19th century, sort of liberal.
So, but Algeria would not be, you know, that was a clear imperialism. That's not. That's a domination of one bourgeois over another.
Yes. The reason I cited the Algerian example was simply because Algeria, it's actually probably the case of Algeria is most similar to Ireland, in that you have an attempt to physically conquer and integrate a region into the metropolitan country rather than have it necessarily separated as a sort of separately administered colony. So
right.
The Algeria,
so how much representation did they really get?
Yeah, no, they didn't. I mean, white people in Algeria got representation, just as Protestants got representation.
Right.
In England. I mean, yes, the Marxist tradition did not really have much time for these racial definitions of nationalism, although they did sort of, there was this focus on objective criteria of what makes a nation, which included things like the economic unity of a people, whether, you know, whether they have a unified economy and things like that. And, you know, Stalin and Lenin's work on nationalism, you know, is part of a broader tradition, which includes Austrian Marxists who, you know, really focused on this question because it was so significant to the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And, you know, more recent sort of academics and theoreticians of nationalism who have sort of moved away from kind of discussing these kind of objective criteria to looking more at nationalism as a kind of political action. And I could put it in this way. Nationalism, you know, John Brulé, who's a scholar of nationalism, he has a good book called Nationalism and the State. You know, he talks about nationalism as a political argument based on some premises like that exists a nation, whatever you think that nation is, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if the people of Switzerland with all their different languages and their different, you know, faith groups or whatever, think of themselves as a nation and act like a nation, they're a nation. And the nation should attempt to be as sovereign as possible, right? So that means that, you know, different community ideas, identities can be imagined in different ways. Consider the African-American movement in the United States. You have an integrationalist movement that calls for, you know, Black people to be fully integrated into the American nation to enjoy. But you also have a separatist nationalist wing that argues for political separatism.
Mm-hmm.
So we can talk about a Black nation in the sense that there were at least a significant number of Black Americans who saw themselves as a nation.
Absolutely, yeah. And so, what's interesting about that, I was reading about C.L.R. James and his the debates within the Trotskyist movements in the United States, and about whether or not to support the moves for a Black nation within the United States, a Black Belt of the United States. And C.L.R. James argued that while it was absolutely true they were an oppressed minority within the nation, they had their own separate interests from the rest of the society, that overall there was a shared culture in America between Blacks and other ethnic groups, and that the majority of Black workers were not for separatism and a Black nationalism, because it wasn't seen to be in their interest materially, and that they were better off fighting for integration, I guess, and civil rights than they would in supporting that movement than supporting Black separatism. And it was more nuanced than that, but C.L.R. James, who I think is a great example of a advocate for Black Marxism for his people, as he saw it at the time, nonetheless wasn't persuaded that what existed in the United States was a Black nation, with the right of self-determination, which would then kind of mandate that, you know, they would have to support that movement if that's what they had arrived at, that it was a nation that had the right to self-determination. But I guess that had to do with the actual decisions that were being made by Black workers.
Yeah, I mean,
anything else,
it's historically contingent. You know, the Kurdish movement, you know, there are many Kurds today even who do not regard themselves, they might sort of regard themselves as having a Kurdish identity in some sense of the word, but do not regard that as their national identity. You have this discourse in Turkey of Üstün Alt Kimlik, higher and lower identity. And so, you know, Turkey is in many ways, you know, is a nation of immigrants. We don't think of Turkey as a nation of immigrants, but during the 19th century, you had massive ethnic cleansing in both Russia and the Balkans, which led to the destruction of, you know, Slavic Muslim communities in the Balkans, Greek-speaking Muslims in the in Greece, Circassians, other Muslim groups from Russia, all fleeing to Turkey, and you know, many of them became pioneers of the Turkish nationalist movement and saw Turkishness as this kind of higher identity, whatever their ethnic identity was, right? Mm-hmm. So there are some Kurds who partake in that and say, look, you know, us in Turkey, we're a mosaic. You know, many of us come from different ethnic backgrounds, Albanians, Greeks, Russian or Tatars, and Kurds, but we all have a unified identity. So, yeah, I mean, again, had things operated differently in the United States, had, for example, there being, you know, some of the southern states being 70 or 80% black, that we might have seen different kind of evolution of politics that might have seen a black secessionist movement. So, you know, a lot of this idea, you know, what groups become a nation is, it's in some sense arbitrary, but it's not random. You know, it's a product of the contingent historical process. There are many communities that could have become, you could imagine becoming nations had history worked out differently. We don't talk about the Burgundians anymore, but Burgundy was a big medieval kingdom with a rich culture, mm-hmm. but its political unity was destroyed. And we see, you know, nobody calls themselves a member of the Burgundian nation today, although it's entirely plausible that had that state survived in the 19th and 20th century, some nationalists, intellectuals would have come along and fabricated a beautiful national history. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there is a debate amongst theoreticians of nationalism about when is the nation. And on one extreme, there are the people who say, well, you know, you can trace back the nation back to medieval or even ancient times. And there are those who say, no, it's entirely fabricated in modern times. I'm kind of sort of in the middle where I think we can't really talk about nations or nationalism before the late 18th or 19th century. But on the other side, you know, it's not entirely random which communities ended up being nations. There were certain accidents of history which led to sort of patterns of settlement, cultural institutions, which, like I said, had Alabama, Louisiana, and Florida being 80% black, I'm pretty sure that we would be talking about separatist black nationalism in those regions. But because of the dispersed nature of the African-American community, because of certain historical contingencies, the integrationist pull rather than the nationalist idea has become powerful. Because the Kurdish population is generally concentrated in specific regions,
mm-hmm.
That provides that creates a basis for what seems to be a plausible nation state, even if the geopolitical realities kind of preclude it. There is a region of Kurdish settlement that you could foresee with a few new lines as being a nation state.
Here's a question for you. It's kind of off to the side, maybe, but it's or more accurately, it's coming from my own, you know, sectarian Marxist position, or my wannabe sectarian Marxist position. Do you think that ultimately, if we were to create a socialist society, that is, you know, not like we had in the 20th century, a socialism in one country that was actually didn't really get to socialism, that was developed at the very best, it was a deformed worker state, or I think it was state capitalist. But in any case, do you think that if we were to develop socialism internationally, that we would, by and large, be looking at an integrationist approach to society? That is, we would become one people or one world? Or do you think that nations would still exist under socialism, divided up by culture or, you know, historical accident or what have you?
I mean, it's a difficult question. I mean, because the reason we talk about nations and nationalism is because, not because it's just, you know, people like to talk about like national myths, or, you know, it's fun to talk in your own language, but because of its concrete impact on politics. That's why we study nationalism. And so if the material conditions of national oppression were removed, and things such as linguistic rights were not so emotionally charged and things like that, I think while sort of distinct cultural and ethnic groups would probably continue to exist, and I think that would be nice for the diversity of humanity, you know, different languages, different cultural traditions, you know, different foods, things like that. All these things were associated with it. I think those would continue to exist. But I think the hot lines that, you know, the ability for politics to sort of orientate along those kind along national, ethno-national fault lines would could be, you know, dealt with. You know, a lot of being part of a nation is kind of almost subconscious. There's a scholar called Billings who talks about something called banal nationalism, which is just stuff like, I don't know, you live in Scotland and you go and do your swimming exam and you get a little letter from the Scottish Board of Swimming, right? There's all these little things that sort of make you feel part of a community. That, for example, if you live, you live a lot closer to the Canadian border to, than I do, but you would probably hear more about news taking place in Springfield, Missouri, than you would be maybe hearing about something taking place in Calgary. So, you know, that the kind of national news networks that make us feel part of. So I think those things might still exist, that we might still see ourselves as part of communities, and we will still need to have some kind of administrative divisions. We'll need to decide on sort of what language is schooling going to be in. You know, it's very easy for
Esperanto, clearly.
Well, you know, it's very easy for members of the dominant nationality to say, well, it just makes sense that everybody learns English. But if you're from the minority group, you're like, screw you. Why can't I go to school and learn my language? And this was a problem that the Soviet Union had to come to terms with. And they, you know, in the early days of the Soviet Union, you know, they were like, okay, do we give every little linguistic group its own, like, sort of medical school? Or do, you know, what do we do with this? You know, there's a scholar called Harun Yilmaz who's written specifically on the experiment of Kurdish autonomy in Azerbaijan during the Soviet region. And, you know, this was like the debates of like, wait, do we, you know, if do we give like all the little subgroups within Azerbaijan like equal cultural and linguistic rights? Or do we just leave them to the Azeris? Is that group big enough? Does it meet the threshold of size to make it worthwhile to have all the educational institutions in that particular language? So I think, with, you know, a socialist state is still going to have to come to terms with these kind of questions. Mm-hmm. One of the problems that the left, you know, from dominant nationalities has often been, and this was a problem recognized by Lenin. You know, he went in his testament, he talks about the risk of great Russian chauvinism from non-great Russians, right? Mm-hmm. So this is a question that we have, you know, that has to be dealt with. Many left groups in the Middle East, especially in Turkey, you know, were often very dismissive of Kurdish demands, saying like, you know, this is Turkey, everybody learn Turkish, you know, don't complain about these identity politics issues. Mm-hmm. When in fact, you know, these are actually quite critical issues because, you know, you mentioned right at the beginning, you know, there are sort of capitalist dynamics that might push against sort of very xenophobic nationalism, but also the state must survive, right? And bourgeoisies are not universal, they're national in form. Mm-hmm. And in Turkey, one of the fundamental bases of the Turkish Republic has been the otherization of the Kurds and the economic exploitation and internal colonialism directed towards the Kurdish region. The big myth, for example, in Turkey is that Kurdistan was always a backwards region, and we have been trying to civilize them, and they're ungrateful. They steal the electricity. They complain when we build hydroelectric dams. They do terrorism. You know, look, we're doing roads. You know, why don't you? You know, it's the same argument you hear with the British. So, you know, India, we built them railways. What are they complaining about?
Yeah.
So, you know,
it's what Christopher Hitchens said about the Native Americans at one point, which was that, you know, it was a boring country until Europeans settled.
Murdered them.
Yeah, right. So I thought he had a lot of balls saying that. And that was before he moved to the right. That he said that, I believe so.
Yeah, I mean, Hitchens is I'm looking forward to Ben Burgess's
exam. Yeah, me too. Yeah. Okay, so one last question for you, Gene, which is, you know, as someone who wants to support Kurdish independence, because I do see Kurdish independence and the right to self-determination for smaller nations to be central to the struggle for socialism. I wonder, though, what the best path forward would be for the Kurds in terms of where to find allies. For instance, should they be looking to political organizations that have a kind of a liberal, democratic, bourgeois approach to the question, like, you know, Woodrow Wilson had, you know, basically trying to force the big nations to abide by international law and create a community of nations that it's more peaceful? Or is the struggle for socialism going to be their best bet? I mean, obviously, a lot of Kurds think that because there are so many small sectarian socialist groups in the various regions. But I wonder what you think about that.
I mean, ultimately, for Kurds, of course, the answer is divided along class lines, mm-hmm. of course. So, you know, in Iraqi Kurdistan, the elite classes that dominate there, you know, they, since taking power after 1991, they have basically replicated the economic system of Ba'athism, you know, the patronage system, just in a more liberal form. So it's a marginal improvement. At least you don't get shot for being Kurdish anymore. You're just suffering under the same kind of system. But, you know, and of course, you know, nation states in the region have been able to exploit class differences in Kurdish society. You know, Turkey, Iran were able to maintain hegemony over the Kurdish region, partly because of their historic compromise with the Kurdish feudal classes, who were, you know, allowed to maintain sort of feudalistic relationships in return for loyalty to the state. So you have these very complicated class things. But ultimately, for the Kurdish question to be resolved, I'm very skeptical, of course, about the sort of liberal fantasy of a kind of rules-bound international order. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of Kurds have had faith in that, but, you know, at the end of the day, it comes down to power politics. And by dint of the fact that the Kurds are spread up across so many different states, and that granting even independence to one part of Kurdistan, even if that part eschews any demand of sort of irredentist nationalism, is potentially destabilizing to other states, makes it virtually impossible for any great power to support Kurdish independence. Even if the Americans might wish to support Kurdish independence from Iran in order to weaken Iran, they will alienate their NATO ally in Turkey. They'll alienate the Iraqi government that they're trying to keep balance with. You know, great powers are generally very conservative when it comes down to, you know, breaking up international borders. There are a few moments in history where it happens, but it's a relatively rare occurrence. And even when it does happen, and, you know, the international community is not on board, you end up with places like Kosovo or the Turkish Republic of North Cyprus or Abkhazia, which are kind of like stuck in a limbo because they aren't fully recognized in this sort of rules-based international order scene. So I do not believe, I mean, you know, cooperating with the great powers might give the Kurds some kind of leverage temporarily for a bet, you know, maybe negotiating with the central government. But ultimately, and I don't object necessarily, you know, people are like, oh, Kurds in Syria allied with the Americans against ISIS. And then it's like, yeah, well, you know, if you had ISIS on your doorstep, and then
they did, right? Yeah, I mean,
yeah. What do you expect they're going to do? They're going to like, sorry, guys, we're all going to just let our heads get chopped off because some Trotskyists in
California or New York.
Yeah, in Chicago are highly offended by it. So, you know, but ultimately that can only ever be a temporary thing. At the end of the day, for an ultimate resolution of the Kurdish question, you need a revolution in not one country, but in across the Middle East, you know, like from Iraq to Iran to Syria to Turkey. And whatever the political solution that comes from that, whether that's a unified Kurdish state, a series of, you know, Kurdish states or autonomous regions or a regional federation, what have you, that's kind of less important. The more important thing is to have a kind of serious democratic change across the region. And ultimately, that depends not just on Kurds. You know, it depends on movements in Turkey, Syria, Iran and Iraq, recognizing the legitimacy of Kurdish demands and working together on some kind of broad democratic front. You know, the Kurdish movement has, you know, there are left-wing aspects to it. There are right-wing aspects to it. Groups have moved from left to right over time. The reason the Kurdistan Democratic Party is called the Kurdistan Democratic Party is because it was founded under the shadow of the Soviet occupation of Iran. And the argument was, well, Kurdistan needs to have a bourgeois democratic revolution before it can go to a socialist revolution. So this is a Marxist-inspired party. Now, since then, you know, it's become a kind of family-dominated kind of coalition between, you know, feudal elites alienated by Iraqi land reform and urban intellectuals alienated by their exclusion from, you know, the Iraqi nation and their suppression of culture and so on and so forth.
Yeah, so you can't get a good university gig if you're Kurdish.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Unless you praise Saddam Hussein. Actually, I'll tell you one thing. The head of the, in 2004, the head of the, or one of the heads of the political science department at Salahuddin University, he had a PhD on Saddam Hussein's theories of human rights, which was an interesting one. You used to hear these stories about these things. But ultimately, the Kurdish question, the issue is less about what the final form of the resolution will be. This whole idea of democratic confederalism, of municipality, is, you know, being forward as being a possible solution to not only the Kurdish question, but sort of, you know, there are many different ethnic minorities in Kurdistan. You know, it's not great if you're, let's say, a Christian or an Armenian, and then suddenly you go from being oppressed by the Syrian state to being oppressed by a Kurdish state or what have you. Mm-hmm. So it's less about the final form, but more about the kind of broad, in a very general sense, democratization of the region and a sort of revolutionary change that will sweep away these authoritarian regimes that thrive on this strife. You know, they thrive on the sectarian divides. You know, one of the reasons that Iraq militarized and became more authoritarian was because of this constant war with the Kurdish population from 1961 right down to 1975. It provided the context for the rise of authoritarianism. Mm. The Justices and Development Party in Turkey, when it moves towards, and this is not the first time in Turkish history, repression of Kurds has often heralded repression of liberals and socialists in Turkey. The repression of the 1925 Sheikh Said revolt, at the same time as you have that, you have a whole host of arrests and trials amongst Turks as well. So, you know, just as the Palestinian question is used by authoritarian Arab regimes to justify a constant state of emergency under the threat of an Israeli attack, the Kurdish question prevents this ongoing internal threat, which allows the military in many of these countries to maintain their influence, that allows them, you know, allows authoritarians like Erdogan, who initially, Erdogan was very cynical about the Kurdish question. Initially, he sort of posited himself as a kind of liberal on the Kurdish issue.
Mm-hmm.
But when it became politically expedient, when the Kurdish political party suddenly became a threat to his dominance in the Turkish parliament, he shifted towards a nationalist alliance using the repression of Kurds as a tool to shore up that nationalist base. In 2015, you know, Erdogan faced a threat from the Kurds who managed to get, you know, deny him a majority, but he also faced loss of votes to a far right political party. And so Erdogan, in a very cynical way, used this issue. So the Kurds are, in a sense, a chain around the necks of Persians, Turks, and Arabs, as well as a chain around, you know, as well as the Kurds being sort of repressed by these states, they are used specifically to maintain these authoritarian regimes. Anti-Kurdism is critical to authoritarian regimes to maintain power.
Well, we should do this again soon. I want to talk to you about the history of the Arab Spring, maybe, because that's such a recent example of an attempt to democratize the region and to see what happened there and what we can learn from that might be worthwhile, do you think, in a future conversation?
That would be fascinating. I would love to talk to you.